Thank you. Probably need to lower. Okay, everybody hear me? Okay, great. So thanks everybody for coming. I know it's everyone wants to run out and see lots of bags, but I'll try not to take up too much of your time. But I do appreciate. So I'm going to talk to you today about a project that we did in New Jersey, which we're calling Pooling for Public Health. I don't have any disclosures. I want to acknowledge my collaborators on this project. I definitely did not do this on myself. So from the Rutgers School of Public Health and New Jersey Medical School, I have Marianne Passanante, who's actually in the back of the room. If you have questions later, you can ask her too. and Phil Halperin. And then from the Rutgers Eagleton Center for Public Interest Polling, we worked with David Redlosk and Ashley Koenig. So we're all public health fans here, but so as we all know, surveillance is an integral part of the 10 essential public health services. And as public health practitioners, we conduct surveillance to monitor the health of communities and then use that information to improve public health and public health practice. So in 1963, Alexander Langmuir called surveillance information for action. And then, you know, later on the definition has been revised, which I have it up here on the slide, but I think that the real major things that we want to remember is that it's the purposes for ongoing systematic collection of data that is then followed by the dissemination and use to actually of the information for public health action. So today I'm going to be specifically really focusing on health behavior surveillance, which is specifically information collected on health-related knowledge and behaviors within the community with the goal to assess and reduce those health risk health risk factors within the community. So some mechanisms that already exist here in the U.S., which collect this information regularly, are the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, and then there's all the lots of other national topic specific surveys that are done periodically by different organizations. What we've kind of realized the main barriers associated with using those mechanisms are the really long lag time that it takes from the time that you conceive of a question that you want to ask, and then you can actually have the data to use. It takes a really long time to get those mechanisms underway, to get the questions on them, to collect all the information, clean it, and then sometimes even from the time of collection to the time of the data release could be a year or more. So our aim was to try to take advantage of known state-based resources and assess the feasibility and affordability of collecting our own periodic statewide data with a public health impact. So that's what I'm going to talk about today. So I don't know how, probably not very many of you know about the politics in New Jersey universities, but the School of Public Health and the New Jersey Medical School used to be part of the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, which was recently merged with Rutgers University within about 2 years ago. And so as part of that merge, we realized that we had a lot more resources available to us and partners to work with. So one of those was the Rutgers Eagleton Institute for Public Interest Polling. They do regular political polls of statewide of New Jersey residents probably every few months, and they are experts in the design and execution of telephone surveys. They have a really great, well-oiled machine there with students who are involved in the actual telephone interviewing, and they have a very quick IRB acceptance of questions and getting the questions on the poll, getting the information out and all that. So this is their website if you want to learn a little bit more about Eagleton. So we got together with David and Ashley and others from Eagleton, and we conceived of this idea of the Rutgers Eagleton Public Health Series. So what it was a subset of public health questions, which we added to a regular political poll that occurred last summer. So the political poll itself had questions on it like, who do you think would be a better president, Hillary Clinton or Governor Christie? And it had also questions about gun control and things like that. And then at the end of the survey were our questions were tagged on. So the collaboration with Eagleton really spanned the whole thing. So we, from the design of the questions, deciding what should be there, executing the poll, and then as part of their regular poll execution for their political poll, they always release press releases with the data. That's the purpose of what they do. So we did that as well. And they also added us to their website, which is pictured here. So this is only a little part of it, but if you visit the website, you can see all the press releases that came out of the poll, and in addition, some students from Eagleton created a blog with some more data from what we did. So, as I was saying before, I think one of the really unique things about what we were able to do with this, the Rutgers Eagleton Public Health Series, was how fast we were able to collect the data and disseminate it. So I wanted to highlight the timeline. So we actually, we had our memorandum of understanding, we decided to partner up, and then in July, or June, end of June, July of 2014, we came up with a big, long list of questions that we wanted to ask, and then we worked back and forth with Eagleton to narrow it down to a more manageable number of questions. And then the actual poll was carried out in 2 weeks over the summer, the end of July and August of 2014. After the poll, the data was given to us within days after it was complete, which was really kind of blew our minds. and then the press releases, we worked with us to get the press releases out. Those happened in the end of September, but really the only reason it even took that long was because we were not used to getting data that quickly and then figuring out what we wanted to do with it. But they actually, our partners at Eagleton did a lot of the initial data analysis for us and then helped us craft the message, and we together wrote press releases which got out statewide. So maybe feels like a little out of order, but just to like let you know who was in the sample, it was the target population was New Jersey residents. It was a random digit dial sample that consisted of both landline and cell phone. After the data were collected, it was weighted to reflect the population demographic distributions in New Jersey, and it had a margin of error. The data that were released in the press releases had a margin of error of 3.9%. So there were 5,487 individuals who were contacted as part of the poll, and of those, 871 actually agreed to participate. So that's a 16% response rate, which kind of makes us as epidemiologists pause and say, is that really okay? But in the world of public opinion polling, that's actually a pretty good response rate. and in telephone polls in general, I think even in public health, we're finding that it's harder and harder to get people to answer the phone and answer our questions. And so actually the American Association of Public Opinion Research did do a supplement recently where they looked at the issue of non-response bias, and they found that these low response rates really don't threaten the validity as much as we would think that they would, making this a viable option. So the questions that we asked, we had 21 health-related questions which were added to the poll, the vast majority of which we actually took from previous statewide and national surveys. So we didn't invent them ourselves. We wanted the questions themselves to have been tested before. And we also, part of that was so that we could take our results and say, were they consistent with other surveys that were done before? So we actually did ask about distracted and driving, and drowsy driving attitudes and behaviors. We asked about home safety knowledge and behaviors that included like use of carbon monoxide detectors and smoke alarms and things like that. We asked about the poison center, knowledge of and use of the poison center, and then some rescue behaviors, CPR and Heimlich. And these are kind of topics that we were trying to look at, which wouldn't be too political. We really wanted to just kind of see how this thing worked. That's how we chose the questions. So in the end, the cost of adding these 21 questions to the poll was $10,000. That's a fraction of what it would cost to do any of the other surveys I already spoke about. But even if we wanted to just say, no, we think that maybe adding it to the end of a political poll wouldn't be the greatest thing to do, if we had wanted to run our own poll, it would have cost probably, you know, 3, 4, 5 checks on at least. And then the information was disseminated through a series of press releases, as I said before, which were picked up by over 20 media outlets throughout the state. We had 70 news articles that were printed about, and also on radio and the internet, about our poll, and we were also covered on social media. So it really reached a wide audience. So this is my graphic of all the headlines and news outlets that we reached. This is my favorite headline was "The Jersey Drivers Do As I Say, Not As I Drive." So you'll see the results from that in a minute. I'm going to show you first just the results that were actually put in the press release, so you can kind of see the quality of those. So I don't know if you guys can probably you cannot read the question, but these are the questions on the reflect the questions of a home safety use. Device use. So the question was, do you have any of the following in your home? During the last 12 months, have you checked the items to see if they're working? And so here we have the first is the carbon monoxide detector, the smoke detector, and the fire extinguisher. The orange bar is that they owned the item, and the red is that they checked the item. So you can see that the rates of having carbon monoxide smoke detectors are pretty good. But, you know, they're not perfect, and these are kind of something that I think most of us think about as being basic safety devices. So that still shows that we have a little bit of work to do in New Jersey. These were some of the questions we asked about the poison control center. So you can just see, we just asked, this is a hypothetical question of if someone in your family might have taken the wrong medication, too much medication, or been exposed to a chemical that might be harmful, please tell me how likely you would be to do any of the following. So then it's like the green is very likely, then somewhat likely, not at all likely, don't know. So this, we gave them a whole bunch of different choices. We even threw in a choice that wasn't a real one, we'll call 211 to see if people are paying attention. The other thing that was actually really interesting, and it's not in this graphic, is we also asked a question of have you ever called the Poison Control Center in a case of an emergency in your home. And that question had been asked 10 years previously on another Eagleton poll, just coincidentally. And we saw the rates of use of the Poison Control Center go up, so that was kind of neat. This is the distracted driving attitudes question. And so in this one we asked, now I'm going to read a list of things people sometimes do while driving. Tell me how safe you would feel if you were a passenger riding in a car when your driver was doing the following. Do you feel very unsafe? So the red is very unsafe, then somewhat unsafe, a little less safe. Safe, no problem, wouldn't even think about it. So you can see that people, you know, feel pretty unsafe when their driver is reading or texting. That's the last bar that's closest to me. And then this is actually just distracted driving behavior. So these questions were asked of people who said that they drove a car, at least occasionally, and they were read a list of activities and were asked to say how often they do it while driving. Do you do it on all trips, on most trips, on some trips, rarely or never? And this I was actually very surprised about, given the fact that you're being interviewed by a person, you would think that people would say, I never text when I drive because I don't feel safe doing it, so why would I do it? But that's actually not what we found. So that, I think, also is another testament to the validity of the surveys. People actually gave us honest responses. Some people did, anyway. So the really other wonderful thing about this is that we have all this data now that we can still use. So we have some additional analyses which are underway, and we're putting together manuscripts on some of these. And we also were able to involve graduate students in the School of Public Health in the analysis of data. We've had a few do their fieldwork projects using our data, so we were able to involve the students too, which is part of the goal of the project. So this is just the only one I'm going to share of some of the additional analyses that we did do. So here we were interested in looking at the prevalence of engaging in the risk behaviors while driving and comparing those to the feelings of safety as a passenger. So this sample we limited to the 780 people who said that they do drive. And then the blue bars represent someone who said that they had ever done this while driving. And then the red bar is ever feels at least a little safe as a passenger when a driver does this. And so you can see, and then the error bars are 95% confidence intervals. So you can really see the disparity between saying you feel safe doing feel safe if someone else is doing it, and then how much you're willing to do yourself. So it's like a really neat quick snapshot of, oh, this is something that we can do. We can figure out an intervention here. And New Jersey is a state where referencing the earlier talk by Amy, where we do have a ban on handheld phone use and texting while driving, and yet still this is what people were willing to tell someone when we called them on the phone. So I think it makes it even more striking. Obviously there's some limitations to this method. It's not perfect. The sample size and the selection limited the inferences we were able to make to particular groups. So we did try to do some demographic-specific analyses, and we found that the variances were very large. So we couldn't really identify statistically significant differences with all of them, but we were able to still identify trends, which is useful for public health action. Non-response bias is certainly still a concern with a response rate of 16%. It can't not be. And then, like I said, the social desirability bias, which likely makes our estimates conservative estimates of behavior. So, again, still making it useful for public policy. So I really just want to kind of drive home, again, that we found a quick, relatively inexpensive way to collect information using existing expertise and resources from another field. So we, in public health school, teamed up with people in the political science arena at Rutgers, and we were able to make this neat thing happen. And we found estimates that were comparable to those from larger national studies, despite the likely response bias. And I just wanted to kind of leave you with what we want our next steps to be. So the big thing is we really want to do this again, but plan it out a little bit differently. So we want to talk to a group of experts in New Jersey and decide, what are the big issues, run it, run the poll, do exactly as we did this time, having the media pick it up with press releases, and then run it again soon after to see if any of the health behaviors or responses to the poll change just from the act of having the results be publicized. We also really think that this is has a great potential to allow us to example statewide change as a result of other types of public health interventions. And we would love to be able to make it really easy to collect and act on local, statewide, specific public health information via a regular poll. So that's it. Thanks. Thank you. That's a good question. We didn't for this project because we were working with Eagleton, and this is their method of polling. But it has been something I think that's been a wider discussion. And I don't know if it's, I don't know what other people's experiences are, but I've been running a bunch of surveys recently. It seems like there's survey fatigue. So I've done like web-based surveys, email-based surveys, mail-based surveys, and the response rates have been generally low anyway, so I think that that's like just a big issue. I feel like we have to figure out other kind of ways to make sure that the information we collect is generalizable, because otherwise, like with the NAs, it takes them, some of them, as long as it does, because you do try to keep following up and following up and following up with the people to get them to respond. So, yeah. Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think in part kind of like the discussion that we've had, which is, you know, how are the results that we're getting now to compare it to results that we got in the past when there was a better response. I think there have been a bunch of publications coming out, because I think a lot of agencies are facing these same issues, where they have looked at smaller samples and have followed up and followed up and followed up and then compared those results to other samples. So I think what we just need to do is to kind of keep checking and see how we're doing in as much as we can. And I think that also, you know, weighting the data so that it can represents the, you know, a bigger swath of the population, you know, definitely helps. I think there are other statistical methods that are being developed to counter that as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, Marianne? Is it, was it only five? Might have been. Anybody else? No? All right. Thank you so much for coming.